every time you tune into CJSF, you make a choice to step outside the box of what's normal and support an alternative. Alternatives are critical for making change, which we need so, so badly these days. I'm Chris Yee, your public relations coordinator here at CJSF, and I see you contributing to social change in your small and profound ways simply by tuning into us. Thanks for being on our team.
This is Sovereign Canada. I'm Mike McCullough, broadcasting on CIVL from the Abbotsford campus of the University of the Fraser Valley, syndicated on campus and community radio stations across the country, and recorded on the shared, unceded, and traditional territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. Today on the show, the Donald Trump regime, administration, continues to act in ways that are alarmingly authoritarian and anti-American. And some experts believe that it signals American democracy is not only in decline, but it's already dead.
It is meaningless to speak of threats to American democracy, to decline in democracy. The cat is not just out of the bag, it is gone.
That's Dr. Emmett McFarlane, a political science professor at the University of Waterloo, and we'll hear from his interview in full. Then we talk about the C word, conscription, and how, in the opinion of our guest, columnist for the Tyee, Crawford Killian, it may sooner or later become necessary to bolster the ranks of the Canadian Armed Forces if the threat from down south goes from a trade war into a hot war.
Conscription has always been a thorny issue in Canada. We had riots in World War I over it. We had an actual mutiny in World War II, and we were very quick to get rid of conscription after the war. The value of conscription chiefly is in encouraging volunteers.
Also, it's been quiet, maybe a little bit too quiet. If you thought Trump forgot about breaking up Canada, think again. He's still talking, and I'll comment on it. All of that ahead on this edition of Sovereign Canada, available to you at sovereigncanada.fyi. Thanks so much for joining me. I have a terrific show planned for you today. If this is your first time checking it out, welcome and thank you. A full list of episodes available to you on our website. Again, that's sovereigncanada.fyi, which you can plug into your favorite podcasting app by looking up sovereigncanada.fyi/RSS. It's on Spotify, and in the next little while, it should appear on Apple, if we can figure out whether Tim Apple, that's Tim Cook, Trump's nickname for him, Tim Apple, can, you know, hurry it up for us, maybe. The threat to Canadian sovereignty hasn't gone away. U.S. President Donald Trump opened up his mouth again, this time in the Oval Office, while being questioned by reporters following an executive order signing relating to education. This was on Wednesday, April 23rd. A reporter asked a question relating to auto tariffs against Canadian-made auto parts. And keep in mind, this is an industry where car parts and cars, they go back and forth and back again across the border repeatedly to build vehicles, not only in Canada, but also in the States. And Trump got back to his old tricks with the 51st state rhetoric and brought back that invocation of former Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and again insulted him by calling him governor. Now, I'll play this audio per C-SPAN, but please keep in mind that every word coming out of Trump's mouth is completely and utterly false. And I'll let you know how I'm sure of that in a moment.
I asked Trudeau, who I call Governor Trudeau affectionately, but I asked him, why are we spending $200 billion to support Canada, to subsidize Canada? And he was unable to answer the question. I mean, why are we doing that? And I have to be honest, as a state, it works great. As a nation, considering the fact that most of the nation, you know, 95% of Canada, what they do is they buy from us and they sell to us. They sell to us. If we didn't buy their oil, if we didn't buy their, and we don't need their oil. We have more oil than anyone, but we don't need their oil. We don't need their lumber. We don't need their cars. We don't need anything. So I said, why are we doing this? Why are we spending $200 billion? It doesn't make sense. If we needed something, that would be a different subject. So I'm working well with Canada. We're doing very well. We're working on a deal. We'll see what happens. But again, you know, why, representing this country, why are we spending $200 billion to support and subsidize another country? Because if they didn't have us, and if we didn't spend that money, as Trudeau told me, they would cease to exist. He said that to me. They would cease to exist, which is true.
Okay, yeah. Canada is strong, independent, and a sovereign nation, okay? That's first. Second, Trudeau never said anything like that to Trump around ceasing to exist or whatever. It's false. Third, this subsidy that Trump keeps on talking about is no subsidy. It's a trade surplus. The U.S. buys more of our stuff than we do of theirs. Okay, do you know why? It's because they have an economy 10 times the size of ours. The difference is about $60 million, too. And if you take the cheap Canadian oil out of the equation, it's about equal. Canada will never be the 51st state. I know that. You know that. And we all know that. It seems one person and one person sycophants that don't seem to have that figured out yet. But we're showing them. One of the ways we're showing them is that travel to the States is way down. It's even coming up in the summer plans that I'm talking about with fellow coaches in youth sports around whether our league's travel tournament will go down to the U.S. again this summer. Whether it'll be safe for everyone on the team to be able to make the trip, and whether we should just avoid it altogether. That's not just a chat with highly online Redditors or blue skyers. This is a chat with regular folks doing youth sports coaching, you know? And I'll bet that these exact same conversations are going on in your life, too. These day-to-day dinner table type conversations, decisions that we're making every single day. More and more Canadians all across the country are saying to one another, yeah, no, that's not happening. We can't risk it. That country's out to lunch. We're done. We're done. So, thanks for the reminder, Mr. President. Thanks for reminding Canadians that this hasn't blown over. We must remain united and strong in our resolve because this is going to be hard. It's not going to be some kind of walk in the park. I caution that even if and when Trump is out of office, a Pandora's box of sorts seems to have been opened up. This idea is now out there in the ether, now beyond Trump. We have to keep wise to the threat for a long time. It could take generations, many years before we get anywhere near the trust and mutual respect that we once shared again. And that's just my opinion. Oh, and how am I so sure that every word, every syllable, every guttural grunt coming out of Trump's face is phony? That one's easy. His lips are moving. All right, still ahead on this edition of Sovereign Canada. I admit it, I absolutely hate this idea. Nonetheless, we'll hear from columnist in the TIE, Crawford Killian, about his idea to bring back some form of conscripted military service in Canada. I think it's gross. Killian believes it would have the effect of boosting volunteer forces. But first, American democracy is already dead. My interview with Dr. Emmett McFarlane, a professor in the political science department at the University of Waterloo. That's next. This is Sovereign Canada. As Canadians cast a leery eye at the actions of the government south of the border and at extreme words uttered in a daily deluge of deranged social media posts by U.S. President Donald Trump that repeatedly threaten Canadian sovereignty, all while dismantling U.S. democracy from within, Americans and Canadians alike are pondering whether American democracy is in decline. Some folks, including our next guests, say that the word decline doesn't really do the problem justice, and instead insists that American democracy is already dead. He's the author of Governing from the Bench, The Supreme Court of Canada and the Judicial Role, Constitutional Pariah, Reference, Re-Senate Reform, and the Future of Parliament. And most recently, he wrote Legislating Under the Charter, Parliament, Executive Power, and Rights. Beyond writing about politics, he's a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Waterloo and the founder of the Courts and Politics Research Group, while serving as a member on the editorial boards with the Canadian Journal of Political Science, as well as with the Review of Constitutional Studies. I'm pleased to welcome to the show Dr. Emmett McFarlane.
Hi, happy to be here.
And I'm surprised you were able to find time to be here, given that list of stuff that I just read off.
Yeah, well, I'm on sabbatical this year, so frees me up a little bit.
Nice. So I would like to ask you how you're handling your sabbatical and what you're going to be doing in your time away from your day job, but I really want to talk about some of the stuff you've been writing on Substack, which is Defending Canadian Democracy. You wrote what, to me, it reads like a wake-up call. Can you make the case for us that American democracy is not only in decline, but already dead?
Yeah, I mean, I think what prompted the piece for me is a widespread narrative among a lot of people who should know better, including the news media, a lot of our politicians, that seem to think that all of this is a storm that just needs to be weathered, that if we can get past this Trump presidency, everything will go back to normal. And I just don't see it. I think even if Trump is eventually replaced with a sane, normal presidency, the generational damage done to American democracy has already been done. Globally, the relationships have been irrevocably altered. There is no reason to trust in American democracy anymore, no reason to trust that there is a strong relationship between democratic allies. And so I put my mind to what do political scientists really think about how we understand and conceptualize democracy itself? And, you know, you'll hear a common refrain that, well, democracy is something that requires the peaceful transition and alteration of government. And of course, January 6th, 2020 raised a lot of attention because it demonstrated that that wasn't even necessarily the case for the United States in that moment, right? A violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol in response to an election that the loser was claiming was not free and fair, and introducing a lot of disinformation around the legitimacy of that result. But because we had Joe Biden sworn in, people kind of seem to forget very quickly that the Trump phenomenon was a really pernicious thing that went beyond just that individual, that Donald Trump had really taken over the entire Republican Party and had the support of nearly half of the American population. And I fear that people were so shocked by the 2024 presidential election result that they lost sight of the rot that had taken hold in American democracy. And so what do you have in the interim and now in the last few months? You have a president who convicted of multiple accounts of criminal fraud, who was allowed to run in an election that some jurisdictions rightly, I think, felt he should not have even been eligible. But you had a Supreme Court, a Supreme Court that includes corrupt judges who are profiting from their position, and a court overall that knows nothing of true impartiality. It is a partisan institution, and some scholars say not a real court, render a slew of rulings that really further undermines any semblance of a democratic state. One ruling allowed Trump to remain on the ballot in Colorado, despite officials there wanting his name removed under a constitutional provision that they felt made him ineligible. And then the most egregious decision really of the modern era, a decision by a majority of the Supreme Court that presidents are not in fact subject to the rule of law, that they hold absolute immunity so long as they can claim that they are taking actions as part of their presidential function. They can literally do anything. A ruling that means that Donald Trump could literally have his opponents assassinated and not face justice for doing so, and then in turn he could use his authority to pardon the people he ordered to commit those crimes from facing justice themselves. That is not a rule of law democracy anymore. And now you have him, once he's sworn in, enact a slew of blatantly illegal and unconstitutional executive orders without any check. The news media doesn't seem to know what to make of this. It seems fearful to speak the truth. It continues to use mealy-mouthed language about controversial decisions by Donald Trump instead of illegal or unconstitutional action. Congress, I mean, I think the fathers of the American Constitution would be rolling in their graves if they knew what had become of Congress, which some of them didn't even think it should be a partisan institution. But beyond that, it was always felt that Congress would provide the most important check on executive power in the American system. And it is now filled with bootlickers completely beholden to a fanatical personality cult around this president. So it's not providing a check. The courts are trying, in that you have lower courts across the country issuing injunctions against various executive orders, but now they are under direct authoritarian threat by the president in the forms of threatening impeachment for judges. Chief Justice John Roberts himself, a man partially responsible for this mess, is actually had to publicly comment on what grounds should be reasonable for impeachment out of fear that Trump was going to start orchestrating the impeachment of judges just for doing their jobs. You have Congress at Trump's behest threatening federal circuit courts with an attempt to diminish their powers. You have Trump brazenly and openly blackmailing law firms across the country that have federal contracts, and some of those law firms caving. And you have a hit squad running around across the country, snatching people off of the streets, renditioning people to horrific prisons in third world countries without due process. America is simply not by any measure anymore a true or full democracy. It is meaningless to speak of threats to American democracy, to decline in democracy. The cat is not just out of the bag, it is gone. And I am not saying that people should stop fighting. I am not saying things can't get worse. And I am not saying that it can't ever regain its status as a democratic nation. But I am saying that there is no reasonable argument for describing America today as a democracy. It is an authoritarian, anti-rule of law regime that currently stands as the greatest threat to global democracy in the world.
Yeah, a lot in there. I want to you had mentioned some Supreme Court justices. The ones that are most commonly accused of corruption are Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas. One of the executive orders that is blatantly unconstitutional, birthright citizenship and wanting to end it. And the hit squads you're referring to would probably be the Immigration and Customs Enforcement crews that are trawling the country and just picking people up. All kinds of just heinous things that are being captured on video. And the government of El Salvador itself published a video showing the supposed Venezuelan supposed gang members that the government labeled them as such, but without any due process, without any actual test of those claims, just off they go and into a penal colony, as I understand it, where once you go in, nobody ever sees you again. So that's just some of the context, further context to what you were saying there, Dr. McFarland. I want to really ask about sort of the ending of birthright citizenship itself, because to me that seems like if they can get away with that, then what's stopping them from picking off anybody who says anything that Trump doesn't like, right up to people in the opposing party or even in the within his own party, and sending them off to a work camp?
Yeah, I mean, the constitutional basis for birthright citizenship in the United States is one of the most straightforward, explicit, crystal clear tenets of the American Constitution. And the fact that there are a handful of Trump supporters in the legal profession willing to countenance arguments against it really shows the basic morality and lack of principle with those people. Yeah, I mean, this is an entire regime. Again, I will use the term authoritarian regime to describe the Trump presidency, because that's exactly what it is. It is trying to subvert anything that might present opposition to him and to the raw executive power he wishes to exercise. And whether it's the creation of concentration camps or these illegal renditions of non-citizens and citizens alike, it doesn't matter if people have visas, it doesn't matter if they're there lawfully, if they've committed no crime. And frankly, if you're an American citizen, I don't know why you would feel particularly secure in a regime that seems willing to do anything. They have not just pushed back against judicial rulings, they have outright flagrantly defied them. They have no real, there doesn't seem to be any reservation on their part about how far they will go. And that's the other side of this concern, is that a lot of people might be sitting on their hands thinking that, oh, if we just get to the 2026 congressional elections, the midterms, we can you know, have the Democrats reclaim Congress, and then there'll be a big check. Well, at this point, with everything that has happened just in these 3 months, what makes you think there are going to be free and fair elections a year and a half from now? I'm not confident of that. I hope there will be, and I hope they will be resoundingly clear in recapturing some sanity in Congress. But there's no reason to be confident that there are any norms that this regime won't break. And that is something that should alarm everyone.
Yeah, including one of the very first acts Trump pulled as president after he was sworn in was to pardon all the January 6th insurrectionists who had been to that point convicted and imprisoned. And some of those folks are now dead after run-ins with the cops and re-imprisoned in other cases. But how concerned are you that those folks are modern-day brown shirts now?
I mean, I think January 6th, 2020 might have been a rehearsal for what might happen. For what might happen after, in terms of any challenge really to Trump. Like, so even if the Democrats capture a supermajority in Congress and try to impeach Trump for, I couldn't list the number of impeachable offenses that he's already committed just in this term. What will happen? I don't see a nonviolent resolution given the cult of personality he has cultivated, given the outright corruption. I mean, he's on top of that. We also have to worry about the way he is cleaning house in the federal public service, in the Department of Justice, in the military military chiefs of staff and the like. This is far worse than his first term, than anything in his first term. And again, there seems to remarkably, despite all of the anger over his economic threats and threats to sovereignty in Canada and elsewhere around the world, there doesn't seem to be the level of alarm that seems to be warranted here. There seems to be a fairly blasé attitude about the resilience of the American system to overcome this as some sort of bump in the road. And all of the warning signs are here. And we literally have scholars of authoritarianism and fascism moving from the United States to Canada because of their personal concerns about what is happening. And if that doesn't wake people up, I don't know what will.
Yeah, I think it's a heavy American exceptionalism that seems to make people think everything's going to be all right. We can't be, you know, it can't happen here type of thing, but it sure seems to be happening. You caution that political leaders must adopt a warlike effort to rapidly shift Canada away from the orbit of the U.S. What do you make of political leaders north of the border thinking that this is all some sort of negotiation, or we need to find ways to stay on Trump's good graces? What can you say to folks like Premier of Alberta, Danielle Smith, and Premier of Ontario, Doug Ford, who seems to go back and forth between whether he's anti-Trump or like in his back pocket? So what do you say to those types of folks who don't really seem to be getting it?
Yeah, I mean, I really see three categories of Canadian responses to, and none of them are actually adopted the stance I think is necessary to meet the moment. The first category is the most troubling and the most heinous, and that is politicians like Danielle Smith and Scott Moe, or Preston Manning, who came out of the woodwork to threaten Alberta secession if the federal election here doesn't go the way he wants. These are MAGA politicians in Canada who are actually fully supportive of the Trump agenda and are happy to actually disrupt and act in opposition to Canada's interests to support their own. Danielle Smith is, instead of responding to Trump's threats against Canadian sovereignty and our economy, instead of critiquing him, she attacked Canada. She attacked the federal government. She started generating lists of demands and making threats to national unity. These people are not by any stretch in the legal sense guilty of treason, but it's not inaccurate in a moral sense to describe them as treasonous. Then there's kind of the mainstream, much larger group of Canadian politicians who think our way out of this is to negotiate, again, weather the storm. And if anything, after this, maybe we can have an even closer relationship with the United States. And that's the Doug Ford model, right? So Doug Ford managed to really trick people into thinking he was the man. He was Captain Canada in this fight against Trump because of his very strong rhetoric against the Trump tariffs and his willingness to engage, unlike Danielle Smith, his willingness to engage in retaliatory measures and even to threaten to cut off electricity in the northeast of the United States in our integrated electrical grid. But he continuously and to this day talks about a Can-Am fortress, that we should really deepen continental integration, not just economically, but militarily, diplomatically, in terms of resources. And this is just such short-sighted, dangerous thinking. We're in this mess precisely because not only did Trump violate half a dozen agreements and international accords, he violated his very own trade agreement that he negotiated with Canada by bringing in these tariffs. So why should we trust anything that the United States has to offer by way of negotiations? And so we desperately need a warlike effort to really pivot away from the United States. And that's not to adopt a naive view that geography makes that easy or even fully possible. We will always have trade, you know, short of outright war breaking out. We are always going to have a pretty deep trade relationship with the United States just by virtue of geography and being locked in a continent with them. But we can, I believe, dramatically diversify our trade relations. But it requires a warlike effort to build infrastructure, to get goods to ports in the West and the East, and perhaps even the North, as climate change will make it more and more feasible. and to develop industry, to support industry in the long run geared towards that, transportation infrastructure and the like, domestic manufacturing industries, particularly in critical